not a spring or an itch. Pain rash, swelling, a twitch. Call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky. Dr. Lasky.
Welcome to another edition of the Hey Doc Show. Harold Lasky is both the medical director and a physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida, and will be your host for the next half hour. With him is his lovely wife Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT and X-ray tech. Together, they hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining.
Well, one more week and we should be seeing the Christmas items being brought into the stores across the country. You know, two articles whose titles ended up on a website that specializes in healthcare news this week were Diabetes Medicine Metformin Recalled Due to Potential Cancer-Causing Chemical, and another, Diabetes Drug Metformin May Cut Cancer Death Risk. Now let's talk about the first one that was seen on the Tech Times Thursday.
The article started out with this warning. UK health chiefs have ordered a medication used by millions of diabetics around the world, Metformin, be recalled due to finding of a chemical contained in the oral medication called NDMA.
This chemical has been known to cause cancer and was once used to produce rocket fuel. The chemical's use was discontinued once very high levels of it contaminated the air, water, and land surrounding the manufacturing plants. It has been pulled from every single pharmacy in the UK as a result of this finding.
However, England's regulatory agency, MHRA, couldn't really ask people to stop using it immediately because it would pose risks unless those patients prescribed the medication talked to their general physician first.
Scary, huh? Well, how about that second headline? Diabetes drug metformin may cut cancer death risk. In this article, it was noted that metformin was found to have the potential to cut cancer death risks.
The researchers found that women with both cancer and type 2 diabetes have a 45% more chance of dying from cancer than those who have cancer but does not have diabetes.
The striking finding here is that women with cancer who took metformin for type 2 diabetes treatment had the same risk of dying as those without diabetes at all. So it was postulated that metformin users, especially those using it long term, are at a lower risk of developing certain cancers and dying from cancer compared to users of other anti-diabetes medications.
They are encompassing. Results suggest that diabetes is still a risk factor for cancer and cancer-associated death, but that those taking metformin may have less risk than those diabetics not on metformin.
Unless, of course, where they live in England, where NMDA may be in the medication. Remember at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, we were told that one reason that it was so dangerous was that you could transmit the virus even before having symptoms? Now, this was pretty scary stuff. Now it has been shown that people with Delta variant can transmit the virus 2 days before having any symptoms. In fact, pre-symptomatic transmission may account for nearly 3/4 of all Delta variant infections.
Remember that even vaccinated people with rare breakthrough infections may also be able to transmit the virus as easily as unvaccinated people because of elevated viral loads.
This does not mean that vaccinations are unnecessary or useless. In fact, the opposite is true, since those vaccinated who do get the symptoms are much less at risk of having severe illness and much less at dying from COVID-19 than those that remained unvaccinated. You know, go to any gambling house and stand around the roulette table. Pretty soon you should hear screams of joy from a person who hit the exact number and won 36 times their bet. True, 35 times out of the 36, they lose, but there's always a chance.
Yes, those vaccinated can get COVID-19, and yes, those that are vaccinated can die from COVID-19, but the chances are far less than for those that are unvaccinated.
What we're talking about here is transmission, since those vaccinated are breathing the same air as those that are not vaccinated, they may still have a high chance of breathing out those same COVID-19 viruses into the air and infecting others, including those that are not vaccinated. So by getting vaccinated, you do yourself and those around you a favor.
Experts continue to contend that vaccines remain our best available tools to control the spread of COVID-19 and protect people from serious disease, hospitalization, and death.
Research suggests the gap between receiving a positive test to feeling symptoms was just 0.8 days for COVID-19 previously. Now, with the Delta variant, it's over double that time at 1.8 days. The Delta strain is more contagious. Well, for several reasons, one of which is the fact that infected individuals carry and shed more virus than previous versions.
Over time, it appears that this Delta variant has developed an ability, in some instances, to partially evade the immunity provided by vaccination.
This means that there are more breakthrough infections in vaccinated individuals from the Delta variant than were seen from previous versions of the virus.
But the researchers have noted that the viral RNA declines more quickly in vaccinated people than unvaccinated people. This suggests that they are less likely to transmit virus to others.
A new CDC report shows that since July 26th, there have been only 6,587 reports of breakthrough infections that resulted in hospitalization or death among 163 million fully vaccinated people, a percentage of 0.01% or less. That means that only one in every 25,000 vaccinated people will be either hospitalized or die from COVID-19.
One of the problems lies in the fact that the Delta virus variant is much more infectious than the previous COVID viruses, now called the Alpha variant.
So while the Alpha variant averaged out at infecting two other people, the Delta variant infects five or more people. And those carrying the Delta virus have a higher viral load, meaning they're carrying more of the virus that could spread to others.
A new analysis suggests there have been fewer undocumented cases than previously thought. Sounds good, but this could actually be thought of as bad news.
This is mainly a mathematical problem. This number, that's the number of undocumented cases, is critical since it is used to calculate the fatality rate. That is, what proportion of the population will die from the disease. That number also is used to calculate what proportion of the population might already have substantial immunity, which might change vaccination thresholds targeting herd immunity. And it would also help us plan for the future.
So, the actual number of total people with COVID infections have been very tricky to pin down, especially since so many people are transmitting the disease without demonstrating any symptoms.
These people end up not being counted in the infection population pool. Now, the old approach that the CDC has used to estimate the true cumulative incidence of SARS-CoV-2 infections is to assume that three-quarters of all people that are actually positive for the virus are actually untested.
The CDC, using this calculation, suggests that there are around 140 million infections in the U.S., even though only somewhere around 30 million tests were actually positive.
But we need a new approach, one that gives us a truer and therefore more valuable estimate of the number of people who have and have had the infection. One way that many have suggested is to create a systematic random sampling of the population for antibodies to coronavirus.
We do this for other things all the time. For example, it's how we know what the average cholesterol level of an American is, for example.
But so far, only two states, Indiana and Ohio, have done a systematic job of randomly sampling their populace to figure out how many people have been infected. So one research group has used those statistics from these two states to get a more reliable number. Using these figures, the researchers came up with a different set of numbers for the entire United States.
The results suggest that from March of 2020 to March of 2021, 65 million people roughly 20% of the U.S. population have been infected with the coronavirus.
So look at those numbers. The new extrapolated numbers found by the research team say that 65 million people in the U.S. have been infected with the coronavirus. Yet the CDC says 114 million have been infected. Pretty big disparity, wouldn't you say? So you can see that this is substantially lower than the CDC estimates of infections in that time period. And as we said, this is not just mathematics or arithmetic mumbo-jumbo. This has multiple important implications. The CDC estimates suggest the infection fatality rate of the virus is 0.5%. Now, keep in mind, this is different from case fatality rate, which is the death rate among people who actually test positive. The 0.5% figure dilutes the denominator by including those who never knew they were infected.
But the new data suggests the infection fatality rate is a fair amount higher, around 0.8% or 0.9%, with a low of around 0.2% in Utah and a high of 1.7% in Massachusetts.
There's still more work to be done in these calculations, since errors still may be due to some of the assumptions of their model, which includes the idea that individuals who were previously infected cannot become infected again, and it also assumes that the correct percent of the population that would be immune due to having been vaccinated.
When the study was done, they assumed that by August, roughly 70% of the population will have immunity, largely through the vaccination effort, and that herd immunity for the Delta variant is probably around 75 to 80%. So this looks pretty good.
Unfortunately, they assume that 2 million individuals will be vaccinated every day, when in actuality, only around 500,000 shots a day are given right now. So we need to be aware that this might end up being a sadder story than we thought, as the new numbers demonstrate that the virus is slightly deadlier than we may have thought and herd immunity slightly farther away. If accurate, it suggests that we may be in for a difficult fall.
This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. Dr. Lasky has been the director and physician at the care center for over 34 years. They are located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection, between the Tulsa Welding School and the old Pottsburg Post Office. They will treat your pain, sprains, and strains. Dr. Lasky and Carmen are proud to welcome Dr. Pollan, a board-certified pain management physician, to the practice. The office emphasizes the treatment of chronic pain. They also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any question about Southside Medical Center, please call their office at 641-4411. That's Southside Medical Center, where your health is their primary care.
Last week, we spoke in some detail about diabetes mellitus. We even talked about some aspects of the treatment today as well. We had also mentioned another disease that uses the term diabetes, but it's a much different disease. It is called diabetes insipidus.
The word diabetes comes from the Greek word meaning to siphon or pass through, while the word mellitus is related to honey or sweet. So now we have diabetes insipidus. The term insipidus just denotes something that's drab, boring, or banal. Diabetes insipidus is really a rare condition where the two main symptoms are that you pee a lot and you feel thirsty quite often.
It is not related to diabetes mellitus, but as you can see, shares some of the symptoms. In very severe cases of diabetes insipidus, a person can pee up to 20 liters of urine in a single day.
There's a hormone produced in a part of our brain called the hypothalamus, and that hormone is called vasopressin. It has another name. The hormone is also called antidiuretic hormone, or ADH. And for the rest of the show, we're just going to refer to it as ADH. Its role is to help regulate the amount of fluid in the body. Although it is produced in the hypothalamus, it actually gets stored in the pituitary, and it remains there until it's needed.
So, the pituitary gland releases ADH when the amount of water in the body becomes too low. It does this by reducing the amount of water lost through the kidneys, making the kidney produce a more concentrated urine.
In diabetes insipidus, there's a lack of production of ADH, and that means the kidney cannot make enough concentrated urine, and too much water is passed from the body. In other words, we dehydrate. That is the most common cause of diabetes insipidus. But in rare cases, the kidneys just do not respond to ADH. In this case, we refer to the disease as nephrogenic diabetes insipidus.
Diabetes insipidus affects about 1 in 25,000 people in the general population, mostly adults. And just like diabetes mellitus, it can develop during pregnancy when it's known as gestational diabetes insipidus.
Now, we're first going to talk about the most common form called cranial diabetes insipidus, which occurs when there's not enough ADH in the body to regulate urine production. It can be caused by damage to the hypothalamus or the pituitary gland, and this can occur after an infection, operation, brain tumor, or head injury. In one-third of cases, no cause is ever found.
Then there is nephrogenic diabetes insipidus. Here, there is enough ADH in the body, but the kidney failed to respond to it.
Remember that regular diabetes can have a similar situation when insulin may be decreased in production or simply be an insulin with decreased capabilities. It can be caused by kidney damage or, in some cases, inherited. Now, some medications, especially lithium, you may have heard of that, which can cause nephrogenic diabetes insipidus. If the symptoms are mild, then you might not need any treatment. You will just need to increase your intake of water to compensate for the fluid lost through urination.
Luckily, there is a medication called desmopressin, which can actually be used to replicate the function of ADA.
Nephrogenic diabetes insipidus is often treated with medications called thiazide diuretics, which reduces the amount of urine that the kidneys produce.
Symptoms are sometimes severe enough that you will need to pee regularly and will always feel thirsty.
Your sleeping patterns and daily activities may be disrupted, which can cause tiredness, irritability, and difficulty concentrating, which can affect your daily life further. You may also feel, well, generally unwell and run down most of the time for no apparent reason.
Since young children may not be able to communicate their need for water, you might look at other symptoms which can suggest a disease, such as excessive crying, irritability, slower than expected growth, elevated temperature, and unexplained weight loss.
Now, it's a little bit different in older children, where the symptoms include bedwetting, loss of appetite, and constant fatigue. It's not the most common cause of bedwetting, so don't worry too much about that. But it is one of the symptoms in the older children. Remember that your kidneys contain something called nephrons, which are tiny, intricate structures that filter waste products from the blood and help produce urine.
The kidneys also control how much water is reabsorbed into your body and how much is passed in the urine when you pee.
In a healthy person, ADH acts as a signal to the nephrons to reabsorb water into the body. But in nephrogenic diabetes insipidus, the nephrons in the kidneys are not able to respond to the signal, and that leads to excess water loss in large amounts of urine.
There is a congenital form of nephrogenic diabetes insipidus, but it's still rare, occurring in an estimated 1 in 250,000 births.
So how do you diagnose the disease? One way is by having something called the water deprivation test, which involves not drinking any liquid for several hours to see how the body responds.
If you have diabetes insipidus, you'll continue to pee large amount of dilute urine when normally you would only pee a small amount of concentrated urine.
During the test, the amount of urine you produce will be measured, and you'll need a blood test to ascertain the levels of antidiuretic hormone. Again, that's ADH that's in your blood. Other blood tests may be included as well. If you have diabetes insipidus, your urine will be very dilute with low levels of some other substances.
There is also the vasopressin test, which is done after the water deprivation test, where you may be giving a small dose of ADH, usually as an injection. This will show how your body reacts to the hormone, which helps to identify the type of diabetes insipidus you have.
If the dose of AVP stops you peeing urine, it's likely your condition is the result of a shortage of ADH. Now, an MRI scan may be done to produce images of the inside of the body, including your brain.
If you produce more than 3 to 4 liters of urine a day, then the physician may suggest that you take medication and may prescribe desmopressin, which is a manufactured version of ADH.
If you have more severe nephrogenic diabetes insipidus, you may be prescribed a combination of thiazide diuretics, that's water-losing pills, and a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, or NSAID, to help reduce the amount of urine your kidneys produce. As with everything else, there are risks and benefits to all these treatment plans.
The thiazide diuretics can reduce the rate the kidney filters blood, which reduces the amount of urine passed from the body over time.
The side effects are uncommon, but include dizziness when standing, indigestion, very sensitive skin, and erectile dysfunction or impotence in men. And although the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs or NSAIDs, like ibuprofen, help reduce urine volume further, when they're used in combination with thiazide diuretics, long-term use of NSAIDs increase your risk of developing a stomach ulcer. Again, risks versus benefits.
So you might need to take another medication called a proton pump inhibitor, which helps protect your stomach lining against the harmful effects of NSAIDs, reducing the risk of ulcers forming along with the NSAID.
Well, I thought that now we'd present some weird or possibly just interesting medical facts at the end of the show, so here we go.
33% of those who drink 4 or more caffeinated beverages, such as soda or coffee daily, are put at a higher risk for sleep apnea.
Stress causes or complicates 90% of all diseases.
Just adding movement into your daily routine can increase your level of fitness. You could say that being sedentary is dangerous.
On average, right-handed people live 9 years longer than left-handed people.
The adult human heart weighs about 10 ounces.
Out of the 206 bones in the human adult's body, over half are in the hands and feet.
Over 40 million Americans have chronic halitosis, which is a condition causing bed breath that never goes away.
During a sneeze, all of your body functions momentarily stop, even your heart.
There are 5 million scent receptors located within a human being's nose.
Very high amounts of stress can actually stunt a person's growth.
Breathing in dim light will not damage your eyes.
Eating a meal with strong aromas will cause you to get full faster.
The body's largest tissue and skeletal muscle, which accounts for approximately 45% of body weight in men and 36% in women.
Every single muscle fiber is thinner than a human hair strand and can hold up to 1,000 times its own weight.
And finally, the amount of teenage cosmetic surgeries nearly doubled in the USA in the 2 years between 1996 and 1998.
Well, no one told me about her, the way she lied. Well, no one told me about her, how many people cried. But it's too late to say you're sorry. How would I know? Why should I care?
We would like you, our listeners, to know that Dr. Lasky is one of only a few physicians in the Jacksonville area that has been certified to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. For more information, you can call their office at 641-4411. They have also set up a special website at www.compassionatecarejax.com, where you can get a whole lot more information on medical marijuana. Unfortunately, we have come to the end of another Hey Doc show.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.